The UN says at least 40% of Ukrainians need humanitarian help under horrendous war conditions.
The conflict continues to inflict unimaginable levels of suffering. Countrywide, airstrikes, artillery fire, and ground fighting continue on a daily basis.
Plus, Russian drone strikes target a Ukrainian oil refinery and leave hundreds without power.
At this point, the facility is not operating, but there is no information about victims.
And later in the program, Ukrainian volunteers are sewing adaptive clothing designed to accommodate soldiers' injuries. Today's Wednesday, November 1st. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. Russian strikes are inflicting unimaginable suffering on the people of Ukraine, and according to the UN, more than 40% of them need humanitarian assistance.
People's lives are dominated by the constant sound of air raid sirens as unrelenting airstrikes rain down and destroy civilian objects.
Addressing the UN Security Council Tuesday, Ramesh Rajangham, Director of Coordination in the UN Humanitarian Office, said thousands of civilians have been killed in strikes on homes, schools, fields, and markets since Russia's invasion in February of 2022, and it's hitting the youngest the hardest.
The war is robbing Ukrainian children of education, the stability and safety they need during the critical development period of their lives, as well as their hopes for the future. The mental wounds of the war will undoubtedly affect children well into adulthood.
Meanwhile, the United Nations Human Rights Office also Tuesday said it had found reasonable grounds to conclude a missile strike that killed 59 people in a cafe in the Ukrainian village of Khorosa was launched by Russia. Liz Thrussell, spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva.
The report says that the Russian armed forces either failed to do everything feasible to verify that the target was a military objective, or deliberately targeted civilians or civilian objects, which in either event would be in violation of international humanitarian law.
Moscow denies targeting civilians. The report said the weapon likely used in the attack is in the arsenal of the Russian armed forces, but not in that of Ukraine. A Russian drone attack set fire to an oil refinery in central Ukraine and knocked out the power supply in three villages overnight, while falling debris from downed drones damaged railway power lines in a nearby region. I spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for an update on the ground.
Over the night, Ukraine was again under drone attack. This time, a raid alarm was heard almost over the whole territory of Ukraine, particularly in Kyiv and Kyiv region as well, which was first time in this past weeks. Kyiv was not attacked. All the targets were destroyed on the way. However, we have confirmation from the Ukrainian air defense that two drones hit oil refinery in Poltava region, and at this point, the facility is not operating, but there is no information about victims. In total, 20 drones were targeting Ukraine, and according to the Ukrainian air defense, all of them were targeting critical infrastructure and military facilities.
And Anna, my understanding is that Ukraine also had targets aimed at Russia again, Sevastopol region. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we don't have confirmation from Ukrainian authorities or from any other sources that Ukraine is responsible for this attack. However, again, Sevastopol was under attack, and this was confirmed by the Russian officials. This time, air raid alarm was heard in the city of Sevastopol a couple of times during the morning of Wednesday. And at this point, we have information from Russian local channels and also from the civilians who are living in Crimea right now that explosions were heard in the city of Sevastopol and smoke was seen. There is also footage confirming that the smoke over the Crimea Bridge. According to Russian officials, it wasn't a drone attack and that it was air defense work. However, we do not have any confirmation from the Ukrainian side and we cannot verify this information independently. What's important to mention here is that Sevastopol is under attack for a couple of days now, and previous attack, Russian forces reported that sea drones were targeting Sevastopol. So again, was it the same this time we cannot confirm. However, this is definitely a story that we'll be updating.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Top Biden administration officials told U.S. lawmakers Tuesday that the White House request for $106 billion in emergency supplemental funding, including aid for Ukraine and Israel, is vital to U.S. national security. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin testified as the request faces significant opposition in the Republican-majority U.S. House of Representatives. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
I'm very pleased to...
U.S. officials pushing lawmakers Tuesday to move quickly to address war on two fronts, proposing $14.3 billion in U.S. aid to Israel and $61.4 billion in aid to Ukraine.
American leadership is what holds the world together. And if we fail to lead, the cost and threats to the United States will only grow.
Mike Johnson, the new Republican speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, released legislation late Monday separating aid to Ukraine from aid to Israel. That's a strategic error, according to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
It would do both terrible harm to our values, but also to our core interests. Values because I think all of us are united in wanting to respond to aggressors, to bullies who try to lord it over their neighbors. And in the midst of doing that, inflict incredible suffering.
Opposition to a new round of funding for Ukraine to combat Russian aggression is broader in the House, the lower chamber of the U.S. Congress. But in the U.S. Senate, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has been a key voice supporting continued aid to Ukraine.
Russia would love to see Iranian-backed terrorists in the Middle East weaken America and our allies. Iran would love to see a Russian victory against Ukraine that divides the West and deepens its own defense cooperation with Moscow.
Some Republican senators remain concerned, arguing there is not sufficient oversight of the aid and that the U.S. cannot indefinitely fund a war.
We need to know that we have a strategy as part of this funding. I think it's very important in terms of building support for the funding for Ukraine.
Members of the Democratic majority Senate would likely block a standalone Israel bid, arguing it must be paired with aid to the Ukraine as requested by the White House.
It doesn't meet our national security needs. And as commander in chief, the president's never going to do anything. It doesn't meet our key national security needs.
Austin said not providing aid to Ukraine could ultimately lead to a U.S. confrontation with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
There's no question in my mind that sooner or later he will challenge NATO and we'll find ourselves in a shooting match.
The House could vote on aid to Israel as soon as this Thursday, where there is some opposition to the aid among progressive Democrats. Blinken said assistance to Palestinians would be a key part of that aid.
Humanitarian assistance is also vital to Israel's security. Providing immediate aid and protection for Palestinian civilians in this conflict is a necessary foundation for finding partners in Gaza who have a different vision for the future than Hamas.
Both the White House and Republican aid requests include $10.6 billion in support for Israel's air and missile defense systems. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
North Korea has likely sent more than 1 million artillery shells to Russia since August to help fuel Russia's war on Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The claim is from a lawmaker who attended a closed-door audit meeting with South Korea's top spy agency. The North and Russia have been actively boosting the visibility of their partnership in the face of separate deepening confrontations with the US. Their diplomacy has triggered concerns about an arms arrangement in which North Korea supplies Russia with badly needed munitions in exchange for advanced Russian technologies that would strengthen Kim Jong-un's nuclear-armed military. Both Pyongyang and Moscow have denied claims by Washington and Seoul that the North has been transferring arms to Russia. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Israel's ambassador to Moscow gave new details Wednesday of the weekend riot at an airport in southern Russia when a flight from Tel Aviv landed there, saying some of the passengers had to hide in the terminal before being flown to safety by helicopter. An angry mob stormed the airport carrying anti-Jewish banners as they sought out Israeli passengers. Danila Galparovich with VOA's Russian service spoke to U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Michael Carpenter, about the anti-Semitic incident and how Russia's president is using the war in Gaza to his benefit.
This crisis is affecting OSCE countries very much. I mean, for example, what's going on in Turkey, what's going on in other countries is the consequences of this crisis. So
absolutely right. And we have discussed these consequences and we'll continue to discuss them. This latest thwarted or unrealized attack or mob-based violence in Makhachkala and Dagestan is a classic example of how what's happening in Israel is finding reverberations, in fact, in the OSCE region, not just there, but in other places, too. And, you know, we condemn that violence that occurred and other expressions of anti-Semitism have taken place in other participating states.
We actually saw this anti-Semitic protests in Russian North Caucasus. Yes, it was not only in Makhachkala, but the Kremlin immediately blamed the United States and the West in general, as well Ukrainian government, for, as they said, fueling this attacks and so on. So what is your reaction to these statements of Russian government?
Well, it's absolutely preposterous to claim that Ukraine or the United States would be behind an anti-Semitic mob that gathered in Dagestan. I mean, it's just, it's so preposterous, it's almost hard to comment. Really, I mean, we've gotten used to Russian lies and propaganda and spin and accusing Ukraine and the West of perpetrating the crimes that Russia is in fact perpetrating in Ukraine. This is just, it's truly unbelievable in the literal sense of that term.
Recently, I remember it was in the beginning of a crisis in Israel in Gaza. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz reacted to some demand from Moscow to stop the violence, saying that it's the level of cynicism even I didn't expect. So what do you think how Russia is playing this crisis for its benefit?
Well, look, I mean, Russia is distorting the narrative. When it comes and speaks here at the OSCE, we have not heard the unequivocal condemnation of the terrorist attacks. We have heard sort of a narrative that tries to, as you earlier pointed out, pin the blame on other actors, especially on the West, rather than condemning what Hamas did against Israeli civilians. And we've been very clear that we support international humanitarian law, that attacks on civilians are never appropriate. We've condemned what Hamas has done in no uncertain terms. And yet Russia's narrative is very different. It's sort of one of equivocation.
Meanwhile, Russian aggression against Ukraine continues and the number of war crimes continues to increase every day. Is it possible for the OSCE to find some consensus to create a mechanism, probably to investigate these crimes and to hold perpetrators accountable?
So the OSCE is engaged in this effort. Whether you consider the OSCE to have a primary role, I would say probably not. It's probably a secondary or supporting role. But we have used the Moscow mechanism, which involves the dispatch of a fact-finding mission. We have used the Office of Democratic Institutions and Human Rights to collect information on violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law to gather evidence of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and other forms of criminal conduct by Russia's forces. Now, then it is up to other international actors like the ICC or national actors like Ukraine itself or other countries that potentially have jurisdiction to prosecute prosecute those crimes. And so the OSCE is helping with that effort. There are other actors that are involved, like the UN Commission of Inquiry. In fact, there's NGOs that are involved in collecting evidence of war crimes. It's a multifaceted effort by many different actors, but ultimately all leading in the direction of trying to ensure that there is accountability and justice for the victims of these crimes.
Many experts say that Russia is counting on so-called tiredness of the West from supporting Ukraine, danger of coming winter for European economy and so on. Do you see, sitting in Vienna, anything like that, that the West is tired of supporting Ukraine and so on? Because there are some worrisome publications in Western media as well.
Well, you know, I can't speak to what Russia is counting on or not counting on, but I think if they're counting on the Western coalition tiring of supporting Ukraine, I think they're counting dead wrong. I think that I've at least heard various predictions and prognostications on how the Western coalition of like-minded states supporting Ukraine would crack or would fall apart for the better part of the last year and a half, if not longer. And yet we've held strong and held together. And I think that's going to continue to be the case, because ultimately, I think most governments across Europe and in North America understand, and in fact, many around the world, to include some of our partners in East Asia, understand that this is about the fundamental principles of the integrity, of the territorial integrity of states. It's about protecting human rights. It's about protecting populations from torture and other egregious abuses of human rights. And it's the principle, on the one hand, it's either the principle of might makes right, which is not a principle we want to uphold, or it's a principle of the UN Charter and the Helsinki Final Act, or the principles, I should say, that are encoded in those documents. And so I think that we're going to continue to hang together, because it's so important that Russia not succeed in Ukraine, and that Ukraine actually, in fact, win this war. It's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of determination. It's going to take a lot of resources, financial, military, and otherwise. But I have no doubt that the Western coalition of countries that is supporting Ukraine will continue that support for as long as it takes. And that's a term that we've used, but I truly believe that we will continue to support Ukraine until it prevails. My final thought would be that what we're seeing now around the world with the eruption of violence, including the violence from Hamas, the violence that's perpetrated by the Russian Federation, I mean, this all goes to the type of world that we're going to be living in, our children and grandkids are going to be living in the future. And so when we speak about abstract principles like the international rules-based order, you know, those are not principles that get people's hearts racing or that get people excited about standing up for what's right. But behind those somewhat sterile words are the fate of human lives, of people, of men, women, children who often find themselves in harm's way and sometimes are subjected to really brutal types of behaviors, whether it's coming from Russian forces in Ukraine or whether it's Hamas and what Hamas has done with Israeli civilians. And so sometimes it's important to sort of step back from the international diplo-speak and think about what this means for concrete human beings and standing up for what's right. And I think in that regard, we need to sustain this international coalition to stand up for what's right, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's for Ukraine's victory against Russia, or in any other part of the world. Standing up for fundamental human dignity is important.
U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Michael Carpenter, speaking with VOA Russian Services' Danila Galparovich. A Russian court on Tuesday ordered a Russian-American journalist to remain in jail ahead of trial on charges of failing to register as a foreign agent rather than be released to house arrest. Alsu Kormasheva is the second U.S. journalist detained in Russia this year after Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was arrested on espionage charges in March. Gershkovich remains in custody. At the Military and Editors Association conference in Washington last week, Ukraine's ambassador to the United States, Oksana Markarova, noted the vital role of journalists and the dangers they're facing to get the story out.
This experience that we have for the past 610 days, it's frankly something that we never had before, only read about it during the World War II. During this 600 days, we were just going through the list with our people back home, and my defense attaché, Major General Kremenetsky, is here with me. We have seen that we have already lost during this war 70 journalists, reporters, and staffers. 70. That's unbelievable loss of not only talent, but something that shouldn't be happening even during the wars. But the rules that Russians do not obey are not only rules of engagement, not only the humanitarian laws and rules, but even with journalists. So a friend of mine, who when we found him in near Irpin, Max Levin, he still had his press vest on him. So they knew who they were killing. And I just want to start by thanking all of you and by thanking you and those who are now in Ukraine and who are now in Israel and who are now in so many places covering the war, because it's very important. Without you, the world would not know what really happens, and it would be so easy for propaganda or for fakes or for aggressors to actually spread, instead of truth, spread the false narratives about it. And that's part of the war.
Also, Kermasheva, an editor for the U.S. government-funded Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, was taken into custody on October 18th. Since the beginning of the war, Ukrainian volunteers have been sewing adaptive clothing. Clothes designed to accommodate soldiers' injuries. The Ukrainian government does not release official casualty statistics for the military, but volunteers say they have constant demand for such clothing. Lija Bakalets has the story from Kyiv.
For more than a year, volunteer Olga Skidenets has been turning ordinary t-shirts into adaptive ones, shirts specifically made to account for soldiers' injuries. Before the war, sewing was her hobby. Now it is a way to help the war effort. Skidenets demonstrates how the adaptive t-shirt works. She says it has Velcro on the sides so it can easily open. She says you can put the t-shirt under the wounded soldier, make a bandage, and then fasten it. Before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the clothes were most often worn by patients who were bedridden or had mobility issues. But now demand has increased among wounded soldiers. Skidenet says that when soldiers have severe injuries to their limbs, they need to be fixed externally using different metal constructions. The apparatus are huge, and it is impossible to fit a leg or arm into ordinary clothes. The main requirement for adaptive clothes is soft and natural fabric. Closures like Velcro, for example, shouldn't rub.
Я спеціально обробляю липучки.
Skidenets says she cuts the corners of the Velcro and burns the edges so it becomes softer and does not rub on an injured soldier. Designer Rostislav Satana created a set of adaptive clothing after a soldier came to him with the idea. He says the set includes an adaptive t-shirt and pants. In summer, he and his partners also started making adaptive shorts and tank tops. The set's design is based on soldiers' feedback. For instance, he says some soldiers are bedridden and their belongings fall out of ordinary pockets, so he created different ones. The wounded soldiers also need adaptive underwear made by this group of women from the Kyiv region. Volunteer Galina Grishenko says the underpants have Velcro on the sides and that only volunteers produce them. And the new underwear is not just about hygiene. Grishenko says that underwear is about dignity and the soldiers should feel confident and protected. Recently, volunteers have been using funny fabrics. The soldiers like it. Grishenko says volunteers ask the soldiers, who needs adaptive underpants today? We have space, watermelons, machines. She says it cheers the soldiers up. All adaptive clothes are free to soldiers. Volunteers gather donations to pay for materials. They say sewing helps them to cope with the stress, but all dream about the day when adaptive clothes will not be in high demand. Леся Бакалець, VOA News, Київ.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage of Ukraine and news from around the world, 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.